The History of .NET with Richard Campbell.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything you can get from .NET. And I'm doing lots of online user group speaking. If you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, just give us a shout and love to get on your calendar. And our sponsor for today, ClearMeasure, they make this podcast happen. They're a software architecture company empowering .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. And so if we can help, please get in touch. And also be sure to check out Architect Tips, the new video show. And we enter part two of a two-part series with Richard Campbell. Richard is an entrepreneur, advisor, and rabid podcaster, and he's a Microsoft regional director, the co-host of .NET Rocks, the host of Run As Radio, and has so much more experience and accomplishments. I couldn't possibly list them all. You can find him on Twitter at Rich Campbell, and we jump into the interview already in progress and talking about his new project to write a book compiling the history of .NET. Let's listen in. So another project you're working on and have been working on is the history of .NET. You've got YouTube videos, presentations, you've got your blog, the history of .NET website. Yeah. Before I ask you, how is it going? For people who are not even aware that this project is on, because face it, with our growth, half the people in our industry have been doing it, 6 or 7 years or less?
Oh, sure.
So
yeah. Well, and the product's completely changed, right? Like,
right, right.
Someone working in .NET today, especially if they're new to it, just has no idea of what .NET was like in 2005.
So for those who haven't even heard of this project that you set yourself to, can you give us the brief?
Back in 2017, literally so now 4 years ago, God, there was a party for the 15th anniversary of the shipping of .NET. And it was actually the Microsoft alumni. So there's an organization of ex-Microsoft people in the Pacific Northwest that they sort of stay in touch with each other and so forth. And they wanted to throw a party. And I ended up getting involved for various reasons. And if you go on Channel 9 and look for happybirthday.net, you'll find I did about 15 or 20 5-minute nugget interviews, just little catches, because there was amazing people at this party, just the who's who of the origins of .NET. And one of the things that came out of that was, some of these stories, they're getting old, like it's been 20 years in some respects, even then. And I was also laughing because of .NET Rocks. I mean, I've spent so much time talking to everyone and very aware of their story, of the narrative that they're in, even more than in some respects they were. Like if you watch some of those interviews, there's points where I'm sort of correcting them about their own stuff.
Yeah.
But because it's a very different mindset from someone who's making these things than someone who's helping to share them, which is really, what I've been doing for years. And so I came out of that thinking like, wow, if we don't write this down soon, we're going to lose it. It's going to fade away. It's just going to be another bit of lost lore, essentially. Now, I have crazy ideas on a regular basis. And so because I have the crazy idea doesn't mean it's a good idea. So I went and set about to test it. And the way I tested it was to write some sessions around it. I can give talks. I get opportunities to give talks regularly. So it's not that tough for me to get in front of some audience and just sort of test. So I've written several versions of the history of .NET as the 1 hour talk over the past while for a few different reasons. One is I've learned more. There's what was publicly available and what wasn't. And I was also trying on different audiences, like who would care about this? Do enough people care that it's worthwhile to put out the amount of effort it would take to really gather the story in detail? Because it's easy for the old .NET people to be excited, right? Everyone wants, because they're in that story, and I've certainly had the experience of telling the history, and you can see the room change as you get to somebody's story. Like it's visible on people's faces when you're now talking about them.
Right, right.
The other folks that would react very strongly at the time were new Microsoft employees. You know, I did one at a Microsoft facility for ostensibly for a user group, but there were a bunch of Microsoft folks there, and they're like, "I had no idea, like where these people came from, or any of these bits and pieces of history."
Well, how many Microsoft employees haven't even as much of installed Windows XP versus previous versions?
Oh, sure, you know, you're totally right, and nor think that's particularly important either, right? Like it's very interesting, the view of a younger generation on technology too. But I've also been, you know, once I got to that point, it's like, okay, well, clearly there's some interest. And my next question was, can I do this? So I sort of wrote down the list of like, who would I have? Who's the essential? And so for example, and you know, what were the top of my list? Anders Halsberg, Scott Guthrie, Brian Harry,
right.
Jason Zander. Like these are people that in my experience doing .NET Rocks, like these are the folks that helped create .NET from the very beginning. They lead it today or even beyond. And if they don't think it's a good idea, then I'm not going to make it. Like it doesn't make any sense. And to my good fortune, they all said yes. Now, I mean, I also have the advantage. I've interviewed them all before. I've known Scott almost his entire career, you know, back before, even before ASP.NET. And so the fact that they were all thought it was a great idea and were willing to talk to me was awesome. And so then I set about to do interviews for hours and hours and hours, very long format, through 2-, 3-, 4-hour long interviews, just to get their versions of it. And you're trying to triangulate stuff that's 20 years old. So I'm getting a version of a meeting from 2 or 3 different people, and they're all different. People remember differently. I mean, even if you'd asked them about the meeting right after the meeting, you would have gotten different versions too. So there's a forensic quality to trying to pull this together, which is really what's been the challenge for me now as I've built up this body of interviews, is I'm trying to intersect on some semblance of the truth. Right? No one person's story is the whole story. There's always other sides of this. And that's something that I realized early on, even in those original interviews with Channel 9, it's like, why was .NET 2 so much more robust than 1.1? Well, a big part of that had to do with SQL CLR. The fact that the SQL team wanted .NET to run inside of SQL, not just that it was changing context, going out of Windows into SQL, that was very beneficial, but the diagnostic tools that the SQL team had to make SQL as robust as possible could now be aimed at .NET, and they hunted down some very extraneous, odd bugs. Now, I knew about that story from other sources in .NET Rocks, but it was something I was able to then specifically interview for. So I talked to Jason Zander, who was leading the CLR team when that happened, and then was also able to talk to a couple of the guys on the SQL team that were directly involved in that, to really get into the nitty-gritty of like, this is what went on and how it shaped the product in that sense. It's, to me, I mean, I love the minutiae in this as well. The challenge will be to tell it well in a way that I think it will engage a lot of folks. And ultimately, you know, the real question that emerges, which is, what's this about, this book? Like, what are you going to learn? Like, what's the, and it's that, that's a hard concept. There's a bunch of different angles on this, but, you know, the overarching theme that has become apparent to me is, here's a product that was created to sell Windows. I mean, that's really what it was for. Microsoft had been making a version of Java as the enterprise, you know, the solution of enterprise development was a hard problem, right? What's modern enterprise development looking like? And Microsoft had a very successful version of Java, one would argue too successful. And because Microsoft didn't invent languages, they made their own implementation of languages and then tooled them better than anyone else. So that, you know, if you knew how to program this language, it's a great way to program it. And they were doing that with Java until Sun pulled the plug on them with a cease and desist, which is why C Sharp came about. I mean, they waffled around that in the early days, but today, Anders Halsberg, Mansturian, like the folks that were involved in that decision, like, listen, we needed an object-oriented language with a managed runtime, and we were not allowed to use Java. What'd you think we were gonna do, right? And that's what
changed
they did.
Just enough.
Well, it changed quite a bit. One of the big arguments, and I think a very interesting part of that, was that they also learned what Java had made mistakes on. And the big one was their approach to type systems. So they definitely worked from an informed perspective of the challenge of things like generics. And in, integrated at the very beginning, again, that's another piece of story I was able to find. Don Syme, who most people know of for F sharp, but Don Syme was writing papers in the late 90s around, here's how we don't fall down this path with Java. We're not going to be able to implement this right away, but make sure you do these things in the type system so that we will be able to emerge from this in more mature versions with a good generics construct with better management of typing and so forth. He wrote those first papers in 98, 99. We didn't really see the benefit of it until 2005. But, you know, that's the advantage of the second mover, that they did not make the same mistakes that Java made because they didn't know. You know, I'm not saying anything bad about the folks at Sun and what they made. It was an extraordinary thing. But, you have first mover advantage that you got out there first, but you've also got second mover advantage, which is you see the mistakes and you don't make those mistakes.
Right.
And you sort of get where you are. But that, you know, that is not what .NET is today. You know, we were talking about what's the theme here. Here's the idea. How does a company that's fundamentally built around selling a product, Windows, completely change themselves? And I think the story of .NET is the story of Microsoft making that transformation. The operating system became less and less important, right? In the sense that everybody has to have one, but it's plumbing. You know, once upon a time, the microcode in the CPU was incredibly important. And which machine you bought was shaped on what you felt were the features in the CPU are. Nobody thinks about that today. It's plumbing. It just works. Well, operating systems are in that same path today. You expect all software to run on all platforms. Interoperability is just a given, that the operating system is no longer defining characteristic of the system. And that battle, which really went apart, was really going on in the middle to late 2000s up until the crisis that was Windows 8, sort of emerged as, hey, this is not the most important thing to the company anymore. And the fact that .NET was able to pivot away from its focus on Windows and into its focus on cross-platform, open source, cloud execution was an exemplar to all of Microsoft to make that pivot.
So .NET first version selling Windows is .NET to
first several versions.
When do you think that it switched, and is .NET trying to sell Azure now, or is there something different to it with .NET 5?
Well, .NET definitely Microsoft's goal is to sell you Azure these days, right? And I think that's not a bad goal in the sense that they only get paid when you actually use their product, as opposed to, you know, take the CTO on the golf course, you know, do a couple of rounds, sign a contract for volume license agreement, whether you use it or not, it's not important. See you next year for the next one. Today, they only make money when you use their stuff. So their stuff better be beneficial. I think that's a very rational, you know, very sane alignment. But the creation of .NET 5 is about reunifying the .NETs, right? The .NET fragmented in more ways than I think most people are aware of. And I'll go into this more detail in the book. But the standard framework went through a bunch of convulsions. The origins of what became .NET Core were born out of a different team, born out of a cloud team, actually. You know, a team that moved over with Guthrie to work on Azure and turn it into what it is today. And as those things got brought together, you sort of ended up with adjacent executions. In the land of XAML, even more fragmented than that. So what you're seeing now is the new Microsoft, this Microsoft under Satya Nadella, that works more cohesively, is now trying to clean up the fragments of that battle in the early 2010s that around Windows 8 and around the different ways to build software, and trying to create a more unified front so that you can work on more platforms. So you can actually deliver what developers want, which is that I learn how to code this once, and everywhere I need to run it, it runs. And I can maintain it. So how do you get the standard framework for it, the 4X folks, to move into this new world? Because the features of what used to be called core are just not that important to them. That maybe they are living in primarily a Windows world. And so you've seen that they've restructured .NET so that it can still be cross-platform, but it can also take care of the monoplatform cultures that represent still the majority, I think, of Microsoft folks. So yeah, the WinForms still there. It's in an SDK. You install it a little bit differently, but it's the same thing. Basically works. Oh, and it has some new features. So I think they were trying to get all that done in 5, and they haven't got it all done. Now you're seeing a bunch of that pushed out to 6. I'm fascinated by what MAUI represents. This trying to unify the XAMLs is also part of that. And there's, again, a bunch of reasons for that. It's better for the customer that there's you know, fewer stack choices. It's better for Microsoft that they don't have to maintain multiple versions of things and they can bring that together. Fewer places to patch for security. And the fewer resources you do maintaining synchronized versions means more resources to build new features.
Yeah, and this is the customer, but the developers at the customer, I mean, if you can say, okay, I'm a .NET C# developer and we can write software and make it run on a wide array of computers instead of, oh, wait, we have to have the Windows tablet or the Windows phone, as opposed right. to, oh, yeah, Android, iOS, no big deal. Oh, Fire TV for some digital signage. Oh, yeah, no big deal. C#.
Yeah, could do that. Yeah, and XAML, right? But, you know, what flavor of XAML are you using now? And there's been a lot of flavors of XAML over the years. And so, you know, people get caught in different niches. So, you know, the acquisition of Xamarin ends up being an important part of this because ultimately their flavor of XAML turns out to be the one, you know, it's easier to go from mobile to PC than it is to go from PC to mobile. So what you're seeing, I think, in MAUI, or these are still early days, is they're taking that mobile approach and decorating with enough features to make it worthwhile on the PC. And so we should end up with a unified XAML in the next year or so, hopefully. But admittedly, a V1 of a unified XAML.
Right.
But at least a progress towards that.
And it does help for the managers that probably aren't going to dig into all the guts of what it exactly is. You say, oh, we're in .NET 4.8. Well, what should we do next? Well, hey, boss, I think it's time that we just upgrade from .NET 4.8 to .NET 5. Manager says, yeah. Can we do that in a few weeks? I think so.
Maybe. Well, and for the conservative types, waiting has some advantages because the tooling will only get better. You could have done that 4.8 jump to 3.1 core with the Win SDKs, but it was rough. 5 is better, and I think it'll only get better, you know, by 6 timeframe too. So, you know, does it make sense to be experimenting and moving some fresher apps up, right? Like the real question is, are you on 4.8? Like there's lots of 4.5 out there still too, right? Like actually getting up to the first, let's get to the most current version of standard. Then let's talk about, do we make the jump to 5? You know, what's going to move easily? What's going to move hard? And I've been paying close attention to folks like Mark Rendell, who's got his Recode project, and which started out really as a WCF to gRPC migrator. That's very cool. But bit by bit, it's turned into quite the advising tool on a move from standard to .NET 5. And so if it was me, you know, as that enterprise architect, looking at these hundreds, sometimes thousands of internal only standard .NET framework apps, like I'd be picking the ones with the most traction, the most utilization, the ones that are fussing the most about, we want a mobile client, we want a remote client, like the ones that are struggling with all those things, and starting to run them through these tools to say, how hard does this migration look like? But I've been doing this too long, right? Like, or do we redo this in Power Apps?
Now, talk about that. What is the latest state of Power Apps that you see the success stories?
Well, so what you're seeing is the emergence of a new generation of domain expert developers, right? And we go back to VB and Access and so forth. And a lot of the folks that picked those tools up and started writing code on them were not programmers, right? They were domain experts. They worked in a given field. They were good in their field. They were trying to become more efficient, and they found a bit of technology and fiddled with it for a bit. You know, they went beyond Excel into Access and were able to do some querying, and ta-da, what used to take hours took minutes.
And they probably also sling an Excel formula, probably more complex than a lot of developers can.
Without a doubt, right? And their main thing was their domain expertise, that they knew what the problem space was, and they were learning enough technology that got dangerous. And one would argue ruined their career, because suddenly the domain expert job they were doing was not as important as the automation they were doing. So power, what is the latest version of the Power App, Power Automate space, is an emergence of a set of high-level tools wrapped around mobile and cloud development for that are palatable by the domain expert, because you don't want to throw a domain expert into Visual Studio 2019. Like, it, that's a wizard, that's a whiz-bang kind of place. There's a lot of stuff there. You need to, the front load that you need to know to get started on that is really, really hard. So they've gone back to these much more simple environments. For a forms, you know, data over forms kind of application against existing data stores, possibly against existing APIs, that's pretty easy. And they can get a lot done in a very little time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my advice on .NET Rocks and Runez Radio is like, ignore these people at your peril. They're the next generation of domain expert developers coming into play. And they will run rampant because they're productive. They're going to get stuff done. And what's smarter, you know, if you're a dev, is it's not that hard to build APIs for these folks.
Right.
Right? They're going to need your help. Rather than pulling from data directly, if you've got an API that does a bunch of organizing and so forth for them, you can help them use that. If you're on the IT side, you could try and lock them out of all of this, but they'll work around you. Better still is apply some governance. You know, I look at it as like the SharePoint of yesteryear, where it was running under everybody's desk, like just and it got out of control. I'm not saying it isn't going to get out of control, but like you need to let the puppy run around a little bit. Just not to the point where it barks,
right?
Like, give them enough room to do some experiments and find some results, and then make sure they're securing it properly. You know, they're following our governance rules to some degree. Give them room to be successful. Because it's not like anybody's getting to the bottom of their to-do list around here, ever, right? The fact that someone could take a few projects off your hand, dull projects, by the way, right? Yeah. Thank goodness.
Right.
And you get to use your best skills. They get to use their best skills. You'll educate them a little bit more. They'll take some stuff off your hands you weren't that excited to do anyway. And the customers will be more productive. Like, tell me the downside.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
I was advising the architecture for a developer doing a mobile app for just field, I think some oil wells or something like that. And they were looking at Power Apps versus custom development. And they were wrestling with how to do some of the business logic or that they need or validation that they needed to do with the Power App skill set. And it really helped change the mindset to say, no. You've heard of this view model pattern in other XAML and whatnot. Think of the Power Apps as just accepting the request from the human, put that into a data structure, object, whatever, pass it to an API, get into C#, where you need to do the business logic, the complex stuff.
Right.
But now you freed yourself from having to even write a user interface.
Yeah.
But all you have to do is capture what the human is asking the computer to do. You don't have to process it up there in Power Apps if it's difficult, you know, with the nature that you're working with.
Well, that's the thing. I think you're rapidly going to run into problems. What happens with any one of these high-level abstractions? Sooner or later, you're going to hit an edge, right? And then the question is, what's the extensibility? How can we do more? Do you need to jump to a different form and so forth? And there'll be options there. But we weren't going to take our existing tool stack and make it easy for the novice to be productive. That's not the direction we're going in. I don't think it's the direction we could go in. It makes sense that there's a new tool stack emerging designed for the novice, designed for that person with domain expertise who's just trying to automate some things that they can't get done otherwise. You know, maybe it was on your to-do list, but it's 57 items down, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, tell me again, the downside to knocking a few of those off, that we harness more people who have interest in automation, to get involved, and they may emerge as professional developers at some point. Like, but that's you know, we're running a shortage of people all of the time. The fact that we create new conduits to bring them in is only a good thing.
Isn't that amazing? We've doubled the number of developers writing code in the last 7 years, mm-hmm. and we still need
more. And we're still like 25% behind, right? right. But that's the thing. Like, we're the side effect being that as we bring more automation into play, we open doors for more automation opportunities. So our market just keeps growing and growing and growing. And we haven't had major disruptions, really. Like, the bringing in of mobile has complicated things. The introduction of the cloud certainly complicated things. But fundamentally, we're still keyboards, right? Whether they're touch keyboards on a phone or on a tablet or mechanical keyboards on our keys. We have the mouse, we have the finger, which is a version of the mouse, essentially. You know, that's where the APIs yeah. work. But that's not disruption. Like, you want disruption? Throw augmented reality into this mix. Like, that's disruption. And the programming stacks for those are not going to be simple.
Yeah. And we still don't know how to do speech to text dictation.
Not well enough. Talk. We're still. Because it's actually a hard problem, right? It's not a problem well suited for automation. And heck, you know, I've stuck a lot of speech stuff around my house and home automation. That's what happens when I stay home for a while. And you find out you don't want to talk that much. No, right. It's not really a feature. To me, the augmented reality stuff is more about positioning that technological agent in a place where it can be of most benefit, right? You know, or, you know, put less elegantly, what happens when you wear a dash cam on your head?
I don't know. Haven't done that yet.
Well, I've tried them all, you know, and it is interesting to think we've always wanted a smart agent, right? And every so often our phones act like smart agents. Like, if you've got an appointment scheduled in the next hour and it knows what the address is and it's smart enough to sort of do the assessment of how far away from there and say, hey, you should probably leave now to get there in time because traffic is bad. Like, that's a smart agent moment. It happens occasionally. It's relatively rare. Right. You know, we're starting to see more and more. If we're in a conversation that's leading to an appointment, you know, now that the Outlook or whatever, you usually start to say, hey, should I make an appointment now? And it's trying to guess what you want to do. When you plan a flight, remember we used to plan flights? Like, they would start to try and make calendar items. Like, we're trying to get smarter. But if you could actually position the technology on your head so that it sees what you see and hears what you hear, there's a number of times in the course of a given day where I'm like, gee, I wish I could replay that conversation. And that's what this technology would ultimately manifest itself as. Not so much that I want to record everything and play it back, but that I want a device smart enough to anticipate need.
Right.
Right. Yeah. To say, hey, you had this conversation. That means you want to do this next. Right. I'm really appreciating M365 reminding of emails where I've asked a question and never gotten a response.
Isn't that amazing?
It's a great feature, right? It is. You know, for a bit of parsing. And we could take that up a several notches. But the 3D aspect, both the 3D aspect of feeding your eyes and the 3D aspect of observing the environment, that's some serious coding that needs to be done.
Yeah.
When augmented reality actually takes off in the next few years, which I look at it as the replacement for the smartphone, the detonation in development demand is going to be extraordinary. Because that is a very disruptive way to code. Very different platform to work on, a completely new set of user interface metaphors. It's going to be interesting. I would argue Microsoft's positioned themselves extremely well. And I'm not talking about the HoloLens, but if you look at the way that they approach language and tooling, their ability to respond in their current organizational strategy is very strong.
So speaking of that, one of the key four that you mentioned starting .NET was Brian Harry. And I think that aren't we right at the halfway point of Microsoft has had .NET for more than Microsoft existed before .NET? Are we at the halfway point?
77.
Yeah, right? So .NET started in 98, 99?
99. I mean, it gets called .NET in 2000. So, I mean, you're in the ballpark without a doubt.
So Brian Harry was in charge of CLR version 1, then it moved to Jason Zander. Is that the right progression?
1 and 1.1 was Brian Harry, and then Zander took it over in 2.
And now Brian Harry took a little sabbatical, but then he came back, and now he's working over in AI.
Yeah.
And so we have one of the visionaries that helped bring that significant portion of .NET over in AI. And you know, like, big things are going to happen.
Well,
because of that focus, right?
It's Brian Harry, right? Like, he likes to solve hard problems. That's why he kept working on source control. It's a stunningly hard problem, right? And he solved it. You know, he wrote VSS, he wrote TFS, and then he rewrote TFS,
yeah.
You know, into Visual Studio Online. Like, it's transformed several times. To me, it's fascinating to have him back and focused on a new problem space. I'm sure he's delighted. He loves cracking hard problems. So yeah, who knows what's going to happen over there? But you understand the emphasis for Microsoft on AI is this is a product that has to function on the cloud. It doesn't make sense otherwise. Nobody wants to own the infrastructure to train models and so forth. It makes sense to have it as a utility resource, and it is the ultimate platform extension for the cloud. And same with smarter and smarter edge devices, right? Like very quickly, the constraint that's emerging is still bandwidth. So I was paying attention to Project Santa Fe, which is a Microsoft code name, but I think it's been renamed and I can't keep track of all the renames, but it was talked about at Ignite. But what it really is putting GPUs into cameras at the hardware level. But at the software level, what are we really thinking about? That you train up a model for doing image recognition on objects, and then you load that model directly into the camera and say, only transmit data back to home base when you see something I care about. Because bandwidth is the constraint. If you've littered a production line with a couple of hundred cameras, you can't have those, and they're 4K cameras, like you can't have all that data coming back to the server. It'll kill you.
Right.
And the vast majority of it is crap. Like, it's not important. So you have trained models on each of these devices. So you build those models in the cloud. They're much cheaper to run once they're computed. You push them down to the cameras themselves, and the cameras know when you need to look. That really opens the door to this. When you talk about modern edge computing, that's what you're talking about.
For a number of years, I've heard so much, at least on the marketing front, about IoT. And it hasn't diminished in need. But in order to realize some of these AI visions, the body of developers is actually going to have to get proficient in IoT. Am I wrong to push software out to these?
But IoT is also racing to meet the dev where they are, right? Like, you look at the modern system on a chip and it can run .NET now.
Right.
Right. Because it was, the general purpose compute units for appliances now are cheaper than the ultra lightweight custom ones they used to have. And there's far more developers available for them. So like Moore's Law has dragged the hardware up to where the devs are. And that's why we're seeing this new detonation. They weren't going to learn those lightweight systems.
Yeah. Like Azure Sphere. Oh, you got to write C. Well,
yeah. Who's going to do that? Well, a handful of people are, not enough.
Right.
Right. But as the tick-tock of Moore's Law continues and the compute keeps getting cheaper and more power efficient, it's like, hey, you know what this runs? The .NET stack.
Mm-hmm.
You'll know how to use it. It's good enough.
So with all of your perspective and with even the development world being fragmented, I hear a lot of people say, oh yeah, I haven't opened up Visual Studio in a while. I've been using VS Code for the last month. And but then there's .NET 5 and C# and we still have Visual Studio. And then you've got all the JavaScript frameworks, and then you got Node and all that. So fast forward, in your opinion, is .NET being maintained because of the developer pool and eventually other things are going to win out? Or in your opinion, is .NET continuing to grow and strengthen and attract, and some of the others are going to get squeezed out because of it?
Well, I don't know that anybody needs to get squeezed out. The marketplace keeps growing.
Good point.
So, there's room for everyone and then some. You know, what are the important forces? Well, C# running on Linux turns out to be an important force because the Linux platform runs very, very efficiently, more efficient than Windows when you get into small form factor and when you get into server base, where, I'm waiting for the emergence of the kilowatt per transaction measures. Right, that we're going to keep getting pressure around green measurements, like where did this power come from? And you get the whole debate around Bitcoin and all the compute that's being wasted on that bit of insanity. The idea that we could be more sensitive to how we're consuming things, and that efficiency is profitable. C-Sharp's done a good job of positioning itself to be able to do all of that. The advantage of Microsoft owning that stack is it will respond quickly to change. You know, the challenge, you think about, why did Flash persist as long as it did? Because HTML and JavaScript were just not good enough. They are now, but it took 15, 20 years of Flash to get it there, right? The downside to this committee-based, cross-multiple companies, all with their own forces model to building out stacks, is it takes a long time to get to the place that people need to be, where the individual movers, like, why did the iPhone succeed so well? Because Apple owned the whole stack, and they could move fast, and they were right enough times in a row to dominate in this space, right? And even when Jobs first released the iPhone, he said, if you're going to develop for the iPhone, you're going to develop in HTML and JavaScript, because he was looking at HTML5 in 2007 and saying, that's going to be the future. He just was too soon, mm-hmm. right? And they pretty quickly jailbroke the phone. And that's why the tooling for iPhone was so terrible. It was when they were forced to release it, but it was only meant for internal use.
Right.
But he also wasn't wrong. Today, you can make a PWA that does pretty much anything you want. And arguably now Apple is defending their native development stack because it makes them money and impeding the PWA in some respects. All right. So we've been on this arc of trying to find unified ways to develop. Now you open up the whole WASM side of things. It's like, hey, you know, it's the context of the browser is super important. It's a security context. It has access to a machine, has access to certain resources. It lives inside of a sandbox that makes people comfortable. Why should I have to pick a programming language? Why wouldn't I program whatever I want? And it runs in that context. Well, that's the essence of WASM. So whether you want to write in JavaScript or in Go or in Rust or in C Sharp, you have all those choices now. And there's only going to be more. So we're doing the opposite of trying to narrow down the languages. What we're doing is the same thing we've done to operating systems. Whatever language you want, the platforms will consume it. Right? It'll be in the end, it'll be the same.
Okay. Well, I have as we close up, I have a toy boy question for you.
Uh-oh.
Just here today in 2021, what computing devices does Richard Campbell have in his bag in his office?
I'm surrounded by them, but that's, you know, this is what happens. You leave me at home for a while. It looks like NORAD in here. I got myself a Pixel 4 for my phone because I wanted to get the last generation of 4G phone and skip a couple of generations of 5G phone. That was my thinking around that. It was just that I don't want to get the first generation of 5G phone, so I'll get the last of the 4G phones. I have a Google Slate just to experiment with that I've learned is not a good idea. The Chrome OS has got serious issues, and it's like, I still use it. It's an interesting little device, not a trustworthy device. I use a Surface Book 2 as my laptop, although I haven't been taking it anywhere. As the weather starts to improve, I might start sitting on the deck with that again, which I did through the last summer. I have two primary workstations. I have my writing machine, which has got the big 43-inch 4K on it. And that it's a few years old now. It's not super leading edge stuff. I think it's a 370 chipset and a decent processor. And then the video production machine is similar design, runs a 34-inch 21:9 screen and a couple of others. I'm finally getting set up with a proper teleprompter with a reversing screen on it. So that it's just another screen on the rig. I like my A10 Mini Pro for video production. And a lot of key lights, for better or worse, and a good camera. Those are the most current machines. I mean, the computer in the kitchen is fully patched up. It just got H210 installed on it on the weekend. And I still have a couple of servers in my server closet here. And had to patch my Exchange server from the Hafnium exploits. Which was some excitement last week, and that excitement is not over.
Not many people run their own Exchange servers these days at home.
No. And the reality, of course, is I'm on M365. I just haven't finished shutting this one down. I have a few old accounts in it and so forth. And when I was looking at the Hafnium exploit, I was like, I'm just going to turn this bastard off if I have to, right? Like, if it gets that bad.
Yeah.
But my configuration was such that I got swept by the script. So it found my IP and it did an ELO, which is basically a call. And this is just luck on my part. Because I've replaced the server a couple of times, the server name is different than the outside addressable name. So when it requested the ELO, it got the internal name, not the external name. Then when it tried to make the external call to that, it was not routable, so it died.
Thank God.
Luck, nothing but luck. It's patched now, and who knows how many other people have been saved by the fact that they would have that configuration, that your internal name and external name are different.
Yeah.
But that was the only reason. And I'm pretty responsive. The day that that came out, I was doing those patches. The hack had come hours before the announcement came out.
Nice.
So, but yeah, another reason to turn that thing off, that's for sure.
And I didn't hear any Apple computers at the moment. Am I right?
Not a one. No. Not. There's a couple iPads in the house that are used by people that are not me. Mm-hmm. I don't, I know the Apple walled garden is a thing you have to commit to, and I haven't needed to commit to it, so I don't. So it also means I'm not on Clubhouse, but it's probably just saving me a lot of time.
Yeah, probably so. All right. I have an iPhone, but I know I use about a third of it because that's the only Apple computer that I have.
Yeah, yeah.
And the kids with the Chrome, I have kids at home for a few more years, Chromebooks for school. Yep. I thought originally, oh, this is neat. Oh, look. I have come to hate Chromebooks because, you can use a browser. Oh, but then the kids have to do something. No, you can't do it on here.
No.
Well, is there any software that runs on here? And you look at a few of the easy extensions, and ultimately it's like, this is not a computer.
No. my Google Slate, which runs Chrome OS, in order to run Signal on it, my preferred messaging app, I had to install a version of Linux running inside of Chrome OS.
VM.
I had to launch a VM in a tablet to run Signal.
Right. Okay. No, a VM in a browser operating system. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
The crazy thing is Google's killed all kinds of good stuff. Why haven't they killed this? I think it's just because it's making them too much money. And things, if it's in the narrow enough window, but no, I don't know that anywhere window's narrow enough, the Chrome OS will do some stuff for you.
Well, no, actually, tons of K-12 customers.
Yeah.
Tons of K-12
So they did a good job of selling something, but they can't seem to get it working well enough that it's going to be okay. I think they would like to kill it, but they can't afford to.
Yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, man, this is a great show. I appreciate you coming on, Richard.
Just good to catch up with you, Jeff. Get to talk.
Yeah, it's fun. And whenever there's some more conferences going on, have to go get some beer, maybe sane sized piece of steak.
Well, yeah, that's a good idea. And I think the accelerating rate of vaccines being distributed is going to help all of us. I think we'll be in a safe place sooner than later. When we're recording this, the CDC just came out with instructions now about how vaccinated people should be interacting together and so forth. And that, to me, is all signs that maybe this is actually going to end.
Good news everywhere. Just good news everywhere. Treatments working.
Yeah.
15 of the United States as of tomorrow have raised restrictions, kind of leaving it more local instead of like the whole state.
Yeah, you guys are moving fast. Like the whole getting needles in the arm things, you seem to be doing that really well. So it's exciting to see. We're slower in Canada, no two ways about it, but it's coming along.
Well, I don't think we're going for the whole population. So you can't, U.S. is 350 million. One, it's not approved for people under 18. So cut out all the kids.
Yeah. Although those approvals are coming, right? Like they're still doing the testing on that.
Yeah. And two, I think if you're under 50, you're not considered the at-risk group. And so the emergency authorization for the vaccine, it's like, well, it's not an emergency if you're not in the risk pool.
We'll see. As they've turned up the machine now to make so many doses, I can't imagine them turning that thing down anytime soon.
Yeah, probably so. Right.
Eventually, it's going to be, hey, buy order a super big gulp, comes with two injections.
And the treatments are working. I mean, we got a handful of drugs that are...
Yeah.
I'm hearing story. My next door neighbor nurse said, I've seen 80 and 90-year-olds get well by catching it early and getting one of the prescriptions.
Yeah, getting treated. So we're learning how to manage it. So again, these are all signs. I do feel like medicine has evolved over this pandemic. We're getting smarter. The new generation vaccines, all of this stuff points to some great possibilities as we come out of the backside of the first pandemic in 100 years.
That's true. All right. Well, thank you very much, Richard.
Great to talk to you, friend.
All right. And until next time. keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.